Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. It was a week of reversals, some surprising, others not so much.
First in Foxborough, where Patriots owner Robert Kraft had dreams of a gleaming casino.
This town is my partner, and if they don't want it, I'll respect that.
Turns out they didn't.
Another reversal. This time last year, Governor Deval Patrick was insisting that Massachusetts would not participate in the controversial Secure Communities program, which targets illegal immigrants.
It's very apparent to me that there are lots of bugs to be worked out.
Turns out the federal program is coming after all, bugs and all.
And then there was something a certain presidential candidate said back in 2008.
I believe that marriage is the union between a man and a woman.
Turns out, well, you probably heard what President Obama said this week about that, and we'll get into that in a moment. Joining us now to review this week's news is Boston Globe editorial page editor Peter Canellos. Hi, Peter. Welcome back.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks.
And Garrett Quinn, contributor to Reason Magazine and the Less is More blog at Boston.com. Garrett, great to have you.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So let's start with the week's big political story about President Obama's evolution on gay marriage. The president needed just 8 seconds to make huge news this week when he said this.
It is important for me to go ahead and affirm that I think same-sex couples should be able to get married.
So the question now, how does his position in favor of gay marriage affect his reelection campaign? Does it fire up his liberal base? Does it hurt him, especially in crucial swing states like Iowa, North Carolina, Ohio, and Virginia, which have large evangelical Christian populations? Peter Canellos, what's your view of the political fallout of this?
I think it hurts him a little bit to the extent that there are some moderate voters probably right now still undecided for whom gay marriage is an issue, and they may be, you know, open to Obama, but it may be one more thing that alienates them from him. But I think a lot depends on how Mitt Romney handles this. And there's a debate obviously going on in the Romney campaign whether to really try to fire up their own base by doubling down on an anti-gay marriage position, or to try to kind of neutralize things by staying in the tolerant middle. If it's the latter, which I think is actually the smarter course for Romney, you know, that also mitigates some of the potential alienation on the Obama side, and we can have a campaign free of this issue. So that'll be an interesting thing to see, to
it
watch
really
how Romney plays it.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. What's your take, Garrett?
I certainly think it's a little early to determine how it's going to impact him, because in a lot of the states where there are large evangelical communities, people that really care passionately about this issue, they're already leaning towards Mitt Romney. That being said, Mitt Romney desperately needs the conservative Christian evangelical social conservative wing of his party to come out and help him, because they are the foot soldiers within the Republican in the Republican coalition. They are the people that will raise money. They're the people that will man phone banks. They are the people that will knock on doors, but they have to like you, and they have to really care about you. That's sort of what helped propel George Bush in 2004, was all the anti-gay marriage amendments that were on ballots around the country. These people came out to vote for that, and they voted for George Bush.
So you're saying, Garrett, that in the sort of the calculation that Mitt Romney needs to make, he would be wise to make this an issue to galvanize those people.
Yes, but Mitt Romney has always had a lot of problems with social conservatives.
Right.
That was clearly evidenced in the Republican primary. I think this certainly helps Barack Obama from a fundraising standpoint. I think one in six of his big money bundlers is gay. He just raised, I think, something like $1 million 90 minutes after this announcement came through. And it certainly helped him out at that fundraiser he had last night with George Clooney, where he raised something around, I think it was $15 million.
Peter Canellos, I mean, you talked about the sort of calculation that Mitt Romney has to make. I mean, if he does want to sort of gin this up as an issue, isn't the risk that it overshadows his top issue? That is, he's the guy that can fix an ailing economy.
Well, I don't know that it'll overshadow that. I think that the greater risk is that it makes him appear intolerant, and that some of those moderate voters who he's going to have to appeal to in addition to the base are, recoil a little. And I think that it's a very delicate kind of psychology. I think there are a lot of people in the middle who probably, are uncomfortable to some degree with gay marriage, but they're also uncomfortable with people who obsess over gay marriage and, are throwing thunderbolts from heaven against it. So I think that, that has to factor into Romney's thinking.
Interesting. Well, meanwhile, the Romney campaign had to move into a bit of sort of damage control mode this week because of a high school hazing or bullying incident that Romney allegedly took part of some 50 years ago. The Washington Post reported that Romney led a group of classmates who chased down, pinned down, and cut the hair of a student who was reportedly different, known to be effeminate. Romney was asked about the bullying yesterday on Fox News.
I don't recall the incident myself, but I've seen the reports and not going to argue with that. There's no question but that I did some stupid things when I was in high school. And obviously, if I hurt anyone by virtue of that, I would be very sorry for it and apologize for it.
So there it is, sort of a classic conditional apology. If I hurt anyone, I would be very sorry. On the other hand, who among us didn't spend his or her high school years doing a lot of things that might embarrass or shame us now? Peter, what's your take on this story? Will it die out or does it last and cause Mitt Romney a problem?
I don't know, but I do think it's the kind of thing that will strike some people, not large swaths of the population, but for some people, it'll be a kind of defining moment. Because when you were saying, who among us didn't do things in high school that we regretted, they did, but we didn't, you know, pin somebody down and cut their hair.
Right.
I mean, this surprised me genuinely because it's not part of Romney's normal persona. You wouldn't imagine him being a real bully ringleader in high school and doing something that brutal. So I think that, you know, some people will genuinely be recoiling from this.
Yeah, Garrett, what's your take?
In reading the reports of this and the blog posts of it, one of the most least amusing things to read of it was people describing Mitt Romney as leading a posse. I'm still trying to have this image of Mitt Romney being sort of this ringleader in a school uniform. But I think it adds to this aura that surrounds him of not being likable and being a big bully, being a corporate bully. And I think this just compounds it. It sort of adds to this effect that he was starting to do this when he was younger. That being, of course, this seems, the timing of this, I think, maximizes the impact of this story more than anything else. This comes out right after Barack Obama announces that he's, quote, evolved on gay marriage. So I think if this came out later on in the campaign, I don't think it would have the same impact that it is having right now.
It's an interesting point, isn't it, Peter? The striking contrast, breaking the same week as President Obama coming out in favor of gay marriage.
Well, the contrast is striking. And I agree with Garrett that it comes at a bad moment for Romney. On the other hand, they clearly didn't intend this to come out. And you know, Romney's response, it may have been a little bit conditional if I did offend anyone. You know, it was pretty clear. He's not denying this happened. He's not insulting the people who brought it up. He's saying, look, you know, I may have done some things wrong when I was in high school, and you got to forgive me that. And I feel bad about it.
Well, it's an interesting story. I'm just curious to know if it's going to sort of have legs and continue. I'm always curious about, well, our business, frankly, and sort of what continues to breathe oxygen into these stories and sort of what makes them last. Any ideas on that, Garrett?
Well, you've seen more people coming out that went to high school with Mitt Romney, that were part of his class, that were involved in this. I think if we get more explosive recounts of Mitt Romney in his high school days, yeah, this thing will certainly have legs. Whether it will have legs like the Elizabeth Warren story, and I think that had significant legs, I don't know. But it all depends on how much comes out from his classmates in the next couple of days.
And the Elizabeth Warren story you're talking about is her heritage.
Heritage story, which has had, I think, unbelievable legs, to say the least.
Gone on and on. Well, let's move on and talk about the casino that won't be coming to Foxborough. 7 months after Massachusetts passed a law to permit casino gambling in the state, the people of Foxborough made their feelings very clear this week. Not in our backyard, thank you very much. And a day after they elected two anti-casino members to their board of selectmen, New England Patriots owner Robert Kraft and casino developer Steve Wynn said, "We hear you." They suspended their bid to build a casino resort in town. Here's anti-Foxborough casino activist Holly Steele on WBUR earlier this week.
We are ecstatic. We didn't expect this news, and quite honestly, we are tremendously grateful of Mr. Kraft's decision and the fact that he did hear the voice of the people of Foxborough.
Peter, one of the stated intentions of the casino gambling law was that no community would be forced to have a casino if they didn't want it. The early lesson from Foxborough seems to suggest that at least on that score, the law is working. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. And I think that Bob Kraft, who obviously has a lot invested in his relationship with Foxborough, did the right thing by sort of quietly pulling the proposal. I do think that this obviously will reinforce the argument of those who say that all of Boston should have a vote on the casino instead of just the East Boston neighborhood, because the bill was a little bit weighted towards a Suffolk Downs casino by limiting the participation in Boston to just the precinct surrounding the casino rather than the whole city, when the whole city will be affected.
So. Yeah, and for listeners who might not be aware of that detail in the bill, let's just explain it a little bit. So basically the bill said any community has the right to vote up or down on a casino, right? But when it comes to Boston, it's just East Boston as opposed to the whole city of Boston, right?
Yes. I think it may even be a subset of East Boston, just the precinct surrounding it. It's something that the city council, I think there's some provision where the city council can order a citywide vote, and it's certainly incumbent on them to do that.
So, Garrett, should the whole city of Boston have the right to vote up or down on a casino?
Well, a casino, like a large stadium or any other extremely large entertainment complex, changes the fabric of a city. I think, and Peter's right, that this was written in a bit sort of to favor a Suffolk Downs type property. But I think if people organize like they did in Foxborough, I think that's one of the clear reasons why this failed. You had real, actual grassroots people organized against the casino. If you look at the efforts that Kraft and Wynn took to advance this, they were really top-down, just expensive. They were not authentic grassroots outreach to get people to do this. It was, let's mail everybody a DVD and some shiny glossy paper to do this. It wasn't let's go out and convert people to this position. They got their clocks cleaned on this. They did not do their homework and the necessary footwork to get this project built. So I think that should give people who are wary of one getting built in Boston hopes that in East Boston, if there was an organization to stop it, that it would be successful.
And what do you expect, Peter? Are we going to see a sort of Foxborough style fight against it in East Boston? What do you predict?
Well, there's already an opposition group that's trying to make that point, but it's not quite a Foxborough style thing, because it's not following the same paths. The people in East Boston have already have a huge institution in Logan Airport right there, and everything about their community is in some way tied to the airport. And historically, there've been tremendous tensions there. And I think there's a natural wariness of having another large interest sitting there in the middle of the community. At the same time, it is an economically distressed community, and there are a lot of local leaders who do support having a casino there, including famously the Speaker of the House, and the Mayor of Boston. It's much more likely that there would be a vote to approve it in East Boston, but there certainly is an opposition that's mounting as well.
Well, another interesting story that we'll be following carefully in the weeks and months ahead. Let's move on. The debate over law enforcement and illegal immigration is heating up in Massachusetts again. Next week, federal immigration officials will activate the controversial Secure Communities program across Massachusetts. Up until now, Boston has been the only city involved in the program, which began in 2008. What it does, it electronically checks the fingerprints of anyone arrested and booked by state and local police against FBI immigration records. This helps the feds to possibly arrest and deport illegal immigrants. Here's Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgson, who told us earlier this week that it will help him fight crime.
We're extremely happy. This is a great win for the law enforcement community in Massachusetts.
On the other hand, here's Lauren Rotolo, attorney with the ACLU of Massachusetts, with a very different view of secure communities.
In reality, it's a giant dragnet. It catches people who have really no criminal record whatsoever, have simply overstayed a visa.
Now, Governor Deval Patrick has been critical of the program for deporting a large number of immigrants who had been convicted of any crime. Peter, what's your view of how this program will work and how it affects the debate over enforcement of illegal immigration?
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see. If there are some tragic stories that come out of it, I think that opposition will grow very quickly in a place like Massachusetts. But the big change between now and a year ago was that the Obama administration has been very specific in saying that all priorities will go to deporting people who are serious criminals. Hmm. They're not going to be wasting rather limited deportation vehicles, throwing somebody's gardener or whatever out of the country. So that ought to somewhat ameliorate the concern that, Otherwise, people who are kind of, you know, law-abiding, except they're undocumented workers, are going to get caught up in this dragnet, as the ACLU was saying, and get, you know, thrown out of the country. It may not happen that way.
Garrett, what's your view? Program a good idea? Is it necessary? How's it going to play out?
I'm always wary of government programs that have Orwellian names like Secure Communities, Department of Homeland Security, the Patriot Act. And when it comes to something like this, I found the Barack Obama administration's handling of immigration to be particularly schizophrenic when it comes to handling state matters like this. The way they were very hands-on when they were fighting the Arizona immigration law, but when it came to states resisting, secure communities, they were very hands-off, which I found very interesting. And as far as the enforcement of this goes, I think there's little question that this is going to really hurt police relations with immigrant communities. They're going to be wary of talking to police. They're going to be wary of interacting with them for just simply out of the fear of getting snatched up in this dragnet, which is really what it is when it comes down to it.
Yeah, and Governor Deval Patrick, in fact, he talked about this just yesterday, and he said he doesn't want the program to gin up unnecessary fear in immigrant communities. So we'll see if it does. We'll see if it doesn't. We'll continue to watch that.
My understanding, Anthony, also is that this is not a case where Patrick had an option to just say, am I in, am I out?
Yeah, that was
the
my
law says he has to be in. So right. He's either going to be in or he's going to be in a state of protest against the federal government.
But California, Massachusetts have actively tried to resist this. And the Obama administration has not played as heavily, has not been as forceful with them as they have been with other states that have enacted their own immigration policies going against the federal government.
Well, that's true, but there's a deadline on July 15th, yeah. Right? They're going to have
All right, well, let's move on. Otherwise, we won't have time for our hubbub, that story that fell below the fold. Meghna, let me ask you for your hubbub.
Ferrets.
Okay, moving on. Garrett.
No, I loved this story. So in Connecticut, FBI agents searched the house of Robert Gentile. He was an octogenarian member of the mob who may or may not have links to the art heist at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. They dug up his house. And what did they use? Ground-penetrating radar. That makes sense. A couple beagles. Good noses. And ferrets. And at first I thought, ferrets? Who knew that they had a penchant for art? But apparently, because they're long and skinny, they're very good at, like, traveling through tubes and stuff. And remember, these paintings were cut out of their frame, so who knows where they might have been stored. Now, we don't know if they found anything at the house, but apparently ferrets also were used in the marriage of Charles and Diana. They tied television cables to the ferrets and then made them run down tubes and... And this is for real.
You're making this up now.
I'm serious.
I was with you up until you got to the Charles and Diana
connected
stuff.
Connected the TV cables on the other end. I mean, that's what you do when you get married at Westminster Abbey. But anyway, ferrets as art
I think
sleuthers.
They're creepy little animals. They give me the creeps. Peter, what about you?
There's a parcel called Parcel 9 that's a very desirable parcel right on the Rose Kennedy Greenway, and it's a perfect place for a public building. But the Transportation Department, which owns it, has responsibly sought all different kinds of proposals. It's down to four finalists, and the State Transportation Department is going to decide who gets, at least for a short period of time, the official status of being designated developer. They should give it to the people planning a Boston History Museum, which is something that we've long talked about, that the community has long needed. It can serve as sort of a visitor center, an entry point, but also a place to highlight the things about Boston that aren't related to the Revolution. And we'll draw new tourists and visitors and add a wonderful complement to the Greenway. So let's hope that prevails instead of the private developments, which are otherwise unobjectionable, but would be taking a very prime site from the people.
Hmm. Garrett, how about you?
I'm launching a 501c3 to run Josh Beckett out of town. No, in all seriousness, my hubbub's a national story. I spent almost all of last week and a good chunk of this week in Las Vegas covering the Libertarian Party National Convention, and they've nominated, which is inarguably their most prominent candidate ever, former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson and a judge out of California named Jim Gray. Look for them to play, if the Libertarian Party can ever get its act together, which is always the never-ending talk about them, to play a significant possible spoiler role in the 2012 presidential election.
All right, folks. Well, I think that's all we have time for. I had a great hubbub, but it's just going to wait until another day. Garrett Quinn, contributor to Reason Magazine, author of the Less is More blog at Boston.com. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend. And Peter Canellis, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Thank you, Peter. As always, have a great weekend.
Thank you, Anthony.
Well, if Garrett's nonprofit to run Josh Beckett doesn't work, apparently people aren't really going to the Fenway anyway, because coming up after the break, the seats at the Fenway were once the hottest ticket in town, but now it's almost as if you can't even give them away. We'll find out why. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
It must have something to do with the fact that they're not winning.
Oh, yeah, there's that.
I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.